Hello, everyone. It's Scott Tips. It's January 23rd, 2013, and welcome back to my weekly program. And it's nice to see that we have a good crowd out there. I am in the States now, and I am very fortunate to have with me Marty Wittekin, who is a certified clinical nutritionist, has been for a long time, tons of experience. She herself is a nationally syndicated radio host, lecturer, definitely a media personality, and author of a free weekly newsletter. And I recommend you go to her website, which is www. Get a pen and paper handy, or write this down, or type it in your computer, www.radiomartie.com, just the way it sounds, radiomartie.com. Sign up for that because she has an incredible background. Her books include, but aren't limited to, Natural Alternatives to Nexium and Other Acid Blockers. And she has another book called Aloe Vera, Modern Science Sheds Light on an Ancient Herbal Remedy. She's been counseling people for 30 plus years. And is the host of her own program, Healthy by Nature. That's the one that's nationally syndicated in the U.S., now in its 16th year. Interestingly enough, Marty served as president of the National Nutritional Foods Association, the NNFA, which is sort of the trade organization for the health food industry. It's now called the Natural Products Association, but at the time, back in the early 90s, it was called the National Nutritional Foods Association. And during crucial phases of all of our fight to pass the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, DSHEA, as we call it, which, as you know, protects supplements in the U.S., which those of you in the U.K. or Ireland or continental U.S. or Canada, you don't have the benefit of, unfortunately, unless you have it indirectly because you buy supplements from the U.S., then you benefit. Anyway, DSHEA, as I've always been telling you over all these radio programs for the year, preserves consumer choices. And she even testified, bless her heart, at several congressional hearings and was super influential in drafting the bill. She received NNFA's 2002 Crusader Award, which is quite an honor. She also helped found Texans for Health Freedom because she's there in Texas. And she received Woman of the Year in Natural Foods Award as well, and just has been a frequent guest. So quite honestly, everyone out there, we're very fortunate to have her spend some time with us today. And Marty, are you there?
I am, and thank you for that lovely introduction. I wish my mother was still around to hear it. She would be so proud. Yeah, she would believe it all, too.
Where in Texas are you?
Just outside Dallas.
Oh, that's right. I remember now. And I used to live in Dallas for a while, so I'm a little bit familiar with the area. Back in the good old days, if there were such a thing, certainly compared to today. But
today, actually, weather-wise, a lot of the country would love to be here because it's a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
Is it? Yeah, it's. I hear back in Europe they're having a lot of snow and everything. A lot of our audience lives in the British Isles. Some Canadians, some Americans, some Australians, and on the continental U.S. So this program goes across the world. So what's your expertise, Marty? I know I said some of it, but what would you consider to be like the area that you feel you're passionate about?
Well, other than health freedom, because that has to be a priority for all of us, or all the rest of it is kind of a tough slog because you don't have the means to carry out the good advice that you might get from experts who've studied natural health. But I'd have to say probably because there are much better health counselors around. I act sometimes as triage, but I don't take on a lot of clients because I can't devote the time it takes to really follow them properly. So I'd say a kind of a triage thing, figuring out what direction somebody needs to go in general, and just translating science speak into lay language, because there is a, as you so well know, there is a scientific basis for everything we say, but since the powers that be like to pick and choose and only talk about the things that support conventional medicine, you need somebody there who can get people like you. I'm tickled that you're going to be on my show at the end of March, and then kind of bridge the gap for people that just started paying attention. So I do a lot of translating.
Well, you've done it so well, and you've been involved in this for so very long, and I just really appreciate it. But I have to say, your work on the acid blockers and the importance of stomach acid to me is probably one of the fundamental things, because too many people are, or seem to be, and you could tell me, not me, you, oriented towards excess acid. And yet really the problem seems to be the exact opposite. Is it a big problem? It seems like something like $14 billion a year in the U.S. alone is spent on these class of drugs, these acid blockers. Is that right?
Yes, it's mind-blowing. And it's just hard to turn on the television in the U.S. without seeing advertising for acid blockers. They may have comedians. They have some pretty very well thought out, good marketing to convince people that, and it's very, I think, fraudulent. It's deceptive advertising, because they keep you so distracted with what's going on the screen, you don't notice that somewhere on the screen it says, take this for 2 to 4 weeks, this drug, and because that's all it's been proved safe for. Meanwhile, the whole impact of the advertising, and you'll see it in print as well, is, well, you never know when heartburn's going to strike, so you should be taking this drug. And a reasonable person would assume that means you should take it all the time so you're prepared. And, right. Boy, are they headed down the wrong road.
Well, I would assume there might be some legitimate uses for acid blockers, but I don't know how you feel about that.
Oh, of course. The most glaring example is a very rare condition called Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, and that's a tumor on the pancreas that does generate too much stomach acid. And I don't have a problem if somebody wants to take acid-blocking drugs for a couple of weeks while they heal up a bleeding ulcer. However, you can even treat ulcers with natural things, and that would be my preference, is that you, I have a section in the book on ulcers and some of the things that you can use to heal those. But in any case, you've got to get to the root cause of the problem. And with heartburn, it's almost always the opposite of what you would think and the opposite of what the advertising leads you to think. They say, yes, the acid's burning, but they give you the ideas because you have too much acid. And as you so rightly point out, it's often exactly the opposite.
Well, you know, in my case, sometimes I suffer from acid reflux, and but I know better than to take a you know, like an acid blocker or something. And I never had this problem before, but it seems especially after red wine or maybe too many carbohydrates. I haven't quite figured it out.
And I think you're on the trail of it, though.
Really? Well, I take mascarpone at times, and that has helped. But what do you think? It's from gluten and or from too many carbohydrates, or?
Well, this is what I found really interesting. The book is now in its second edition. When I did the first edition, I put down my experience, which was I had been with a doctor. We had a weight loss program that was based on a lower carbohydrate approach. And we noticed not only did people lose weight, not only did their blood work start looking a lot better in regard to triglycerides and cholesterol and all that, But just coincidentally, they stopped having acid reflux. Their heartburn went away. Their sleep apnea improved. All kinds of things that we really weren't looking for. So I put that information into the first edition of the book, and I said, I'm looking. I'm really not seeing research on it, but I promise you it's got to be coming. Well, by the time I did the second edition, now there's starting to be research, and limited still, but it all points to the same thing that I saw in real life. And there probably are a number of different reasons why it works. And for some people, I do think you hit on something with gluten, some people more sensitive than others. But I do think that if you are eating something that you're sensitive to, all bets are off. And as we get into the actual mechanism of what's going on, I think that'll be more clear.
So, Marty, what would be the best thing? And I'm being very selfish now and just talking about my situation, not others. But so if I'd had acid reflux, you know, at that moment, would taking magnesium help? Would taking, like an enzyme tablet or hydrochloric acid help in that situation to immediately help me? What do you think?
Possibly all of those. Sometimes if people get some immediate help from a tablespoon of vinegar and a little water, and that helps. Or the magnesium would help for the same reason that milk of magnesia does. It would alkalinize, and for that moment, it will calm the acid down. And if you don't mind, let me back up just a minute to say the real problem here. Maybe it'll help people put this in context better. The sphincter, the little muscular ring that goes between the esophagus, which is the gullet, the part that the tube that leads from the mouth to the stomach, the little ring at the end of that is supposed to allow food to go south, but the stomach contents not to come north. Well, something has interfered with that so that it isn't working properly. And so the stomach contents can come back up into the esophagus that has no protection against the acid. So even a weak acid from stomach contents that are really having trouble working because of insufficient acid is still going to burn. And there are all kind of feedback loops, too, because the sphincter doesn't want to work if there's not enough acid to trigger it. So it's
The sphincter of the esophagus is acid dependent then.
It is. And it's also sensitive to, as would be the case with muscle testing, where when you're exposed to something that your body doesn't like, you have a momentary weakness. I think I haven't seen anything on this, but again, I predict we'll see that insufficient vitamin D, because it leads to muscle weakness. That's a muscle. Why wouldn't it be an effect there? Hiatal hernia, that interferes with the mechanics of it. There are a number of reasons, just general inflammation, all kinds of things that can keep that from not working. And if you don't fix the underlying problem, that problem is going to continue to get worse, and you're going to continue to have acid reflux.
I see. Okay. All right. Well, then in other people's cases, in most people's cases, if they think they have too much acid, what's the real answer then? I know the situation may vary, but why would someone want to take something other than an antacid if they think they're having an acid problem?
Well, let me start by saying what's wrong with those medications.
Okay, because, that's a good approach.
Yeah, because that is easy. It's right there on the counter. You don't even need a prescription anymore to get something that will shut down your stomach acid for 24 hours. So, you know, why not just eliminate the problem? Well, it's because the grand design is we are supposed to have stomach acid. It helps us digest protein, create vitamin B12, absorb iron, zinc, calcium, magnesium. So the long-term deficit that we have in those things by not having enough stomach acid causes a whole lot of very scary side effects, including some of them are lethal.
Yeah. Well, then you, in your book, I believe, you list side effects that show up right away from taking these drugs and others that, you know, show up over time. Can you tell us about those side effects that we should watch out for?
Good point. When they do drug studies, they're typically done by the drug companies with kind of a bias toward finding them to be acceptable, understandably. And the short-term effects are things like constipation, diarrhea, headaches, dry mouth, maybe some stomach pain. Those things, people will say, oh, well, I can live with the risk of that. Now, after you get to where you've taken it for a year, now even the Food and Drug Administration has required a warning because they realize people's magnesium levels, and they're talking about serum magnesium, not what's in the cells, the red blood cells, for example, which is a much better measure. But they're saying, oh, you stay on these very long, you risk not only hip fracture and a bunch of other things, but you could have serious adverse events because you don't have enough magnesium. Magnesium is really important to keep the heart beating regularly. And if you don't have enough, you'd have sudden cardiac death. So I'm not really willing to mess with my magnesium.
Right, right. I'm not either. I'm always mindful of Jim Fix, you know, the long distance runner who was in great shape except for one thing. He was probably magnesium deficient, ran, you know, 8 or 10 miles, and then at the age of 50 dropped dead on his doorstep as he returned home, most likely because he depleted all his magnesium and didn't have that to help fire his heart muscle any longer. And so I agree with you, Marty. I mean, this is like super important. And so you're saying that these acid blockers deplete magnesium big time. Is that right?
They do. And they lead to hip fracture, back pain, sinusitis, fatigue, weight increase, problems with insomnia, a lot of things that send you back to the doctor for more drugs. But some of it, besides the risk, increased risk of heart attack, one study, for example, 50% increase in risk of heart attack and stroke if you take Nexium, the most popular of those acid-blocking drugs, if you take it along with Plavix. They don't do studies on this cocktail of drugs. It's kind of a crapshoot.
Right. But still, it's going to have an effect. And that's a really good point, because what we're looking at is a situation where a lot of these people aren't just taking Nexium. They're taking a lot of these other drugs at the same time. And what studies have been done that show that sort of interaction amongst them? I don't know.
One of the funny things is sometimes people start taking these acid-blocking drugs because they're on another drug that causes heartburn. So
that's interesting.
A vicious cycle on a slippery slope.
Yeah. So with all these side effects, then why do doctors keep prescribing them?
Oh, that is a really great question. And I can best answer that by telling you what happens when I'm at a big conference and I'm doing a book signing. They'll be in the line with the other people. There'll be doctors who, when they get up to their turn, they kind of look around to make sure nobody's listening, and they lean over and they say, you know, I know what we're doing is wrong. I just don't know what else to do.
Yeah, that is a good point. Yeah. This is their
and
only...
they're pressured. They're pressured both from the drug companies and from the patients who want relief right now. And some of them are not going to make any changes that would result in improved health. And so they kind of have to. And the system allows them, 6 minutes for the average office visit? How much digging into somebody's lifestyle and diet can you do in that amount of time? So they do kind of what they have to do.
Yeah. Well, it's true. I mean, it makes some sense there. And they're under a lot of pressure to at least have some results. What about this product? What about Pepto-Bismol that some people take? Do you think it's as harmful as the prescription drugs?
anything that doesn't have a long-term 24-hour effect is going to be better. If somebody has to take a drug, I tell them take milk of magnesia, because at least you're going to accidentally get some more magnesium. You do you do neutralize the acid. But the bismuth that's in Pepto-Bismol, not everybody does well with that over the long haul. So I really just think it makes sense to improve your digestion, not stop it.
Well, so if it's not a deficiency of these acid-blocking drugs as the real cause of this, what is the cause?
Well, and just one more thing on the side effects, since we're talking about digestion. There's when you're on these, a 65% increased risk of getting that really awful diarrhea C. difficile, and an increased risk of pneumonia, because that stomach acid is your first line of defense against swallowed organisms, and an increase in dementia. So I think I explain why all those things are a problem in the book, but you have to kind of figure out, and I have talked to so many people. I just did an event on Saturday, and a lot of them came up to me and said, well, you know, I've got, the doctor said I have hiatal hernia, doesn't want me to do, and that's, to translate that for somebody who's not familiar, if that esophageal sphincter isn't right at the diaphragm where it's supposed to be, if it's kind of traveled northward and part of the stomach is protruding through that muscle that helps us breathe, then stomach juices aren't kept where they belong. They can get where they're doing damage. And that's called a hiatal hernia. The surgery for that is very risky, and it doesn't always last. It has to be redone. So the doctors, bless their hearts, often say, don't do that. You'll just have to live with it. But the truth is, if they go to a chiropractor, a good massage therapist, the stomach can be worked back into where it belongs from the outside. You don't have to do surgery. And so that's a perfect example of keep taking drugs forever to solve something that a couple of visits to a massage therapist could solve. It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. No, you're right. Well, then bottom line, how do we improve digestion? What would we do to do that? Some people suggest you eat an apple to relieve heartburn. I don't know what you feel about that or other methods. And so,
other foods that seem to help are broccoli and almonds. And obviously both of those have fringe benefits. And I'm always going for fringe benefits instead of side effects. And because you're improving something at the same time. Cutting back on the carbohydrates, that seems to be kind of and particularly the refined, useless, empty carbohydrates that are making us fat and sick anyway, good idea to cut back on those. That helps, seems to be across the board. But there are a lot of things that also seem to help most people. Enzymes are one. Probiotics are another, because it improves overall digestion. So we have the nutrients on board to repair what needs to be repaired.
So no more Krispy Kreme donuts for me, huh? No.
Somehow I doubt that that's part of your routine.
No, it's not my routine. But
those are the poster child for bad food, really. If you can think about anything that could be wrong with a food, that's got it.
Oh, really? That's going to be it with the trans fatty acids and all of that, or trans fats, I should say, and all of that. So, well, let me, you know, we have people asking questions on the chat line, and one person asks, are we actually malnourishing ourselves with antacids, and doesn't it actually take zinc to make hydrochloric acid? It seems like most people are deficient in zinc, so perhaps we don't have the ingredients to make the hydrochloric acid that we need.
That is a very, very intelligent question, and right on both counts. Because we don't absorb nutrients, and particularly the minerals and B12, which we could do a whole hour just on B12, it is a case of self-generated malnutrition, no matter how good your diet and your supplements are. And zinc is needed for hydrochloric acid, so you get into a vicious cycle. And it maybe is one explanation why They did a study where they took people who did not have heartburn, perfectly healthy, gave them the proton pump inhibitor for a few weeks, and then withdrew it. They all had heartburn, had to go back on the drugs. So I think they have generated something that is just a very vicious cycle.
Hmm. Okay. Well, that actually helps explain some things to me that I've had some blank spots in my nutritional knowledge, and it definitely helps with that. So, and if we are making some acid, why does the acid get to where it doesn't belong? You've kind of answered that a little bit, but what do you think? Is there something about that that we need to be careful of?
Well, there are other reasons we talked about. The insufficient acid, if you've got a stomach full of food and some digestive juices but not enough acid, the food sits there too long, increases the risk that you bend over to tie your shoe, you eventually go to bed, the food's still sitting there, and then gravity is working against you. Tight clothing, being overweight puts pressure. Exercise, you shouldn't swim a half an hour theoretically after eating. I don't think that's the problem, but lifting weights might be, because you're just creating pressure on the stomach that's pushing the contents north. And whatever is going on with you that might weaken that lower esophageal sphincter, that's going to be a problem. Because it's just you haven't shut off the ability for the liquid to splash back up where it doesn't belong.
Oh, I see. Okay. So actually, the low stomach acid is actually causing the burning. It's not too much stomach acid, so we need to take care of that, right?
Right.
Exactly. Okay. I know you could do a whole show on this, and maybe at some point we would, but let me just, without belaboring it, are there any clues that you know of to having low stomach acid, and what we could know to do to know that it's low? I mean, how would we know that we have insufficient, especially if we aren't showing some of these symptoms like acid reflux or heartburn or things of that sort?
If you're middle-aged and older, I would really suspect it, because it does decline. The stomach acid production declines over time. And if you have any of these symptoms like anemia, fatigue, asthma, autoimmune conditions, bloating, constipation, gallbladder disease, if your hair is getting thin, weak, or brittle, people that are hungry all the time, macular degeneration, eczema, osteoporosis, any of those kinds of things are clues, and you can get a test for it, but probably the easiest thing is to just do a trial to see if either supplementing, I like to start out people kind of slowly with an enzyme that has some hydrochloric in it rather than just a bunch of hydrochloric acid, but you can try alcohol is a whole other topic, but you can try the vinegar, a little bit of vinegar in water, and if that makes it better, then that's a clue. Or bitters. Bitters are another way to generate more stomach acid, and see if those things help, then you know you're kind of headed in the right direction.
So actually, it was one of the things I picked up from that is you also mentioned it as a possible cause or contributing factor to macular degeneration. Have you really found that to be often the case? That to me is quite interesting that it could do that.
I got that tidbit from Dr. Jonathan Wright.
He's
always way ahead of his time.
Yeah. And I think he's also taught that brittle nails with this longitudinal ridging, and as you said, hair that breaks is a sure sign. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense to you? And
It does. And when your stomach acid is low, it throws off the pH all through the rest of the digestive tract. So you're maybe not going to get the release of the other digestive juices that you need. And it can lead to dysbiosis, which in turn leads to leaky gut. I think it contributes to autoimmune diseases. And just like people to do whatever they can to support their digestion rather than just say, oh, well, I guess that was one of those mistakes like our appendix and our tonsils. Let's just ignore our stomach.
Well, one of our listeners asked the question about whether certain salts in the body are important here, like the Himalayan salt, perhaps, and maybe that would help. Not table salt so much, but some of these more complete salts. Do you think that would help at all with this problem of low stomach acid or any of the symptoms of low
I've often wondered about that, and I do recommend Celtic sea salt, Himalayan salt, even real salt. Nothing, usually from the grocery store. But because hydrochloric acid, the other part of that is chloride. And people that are on extremely low sodium diets are probably not only risking annoying their adrenal glands and just throwing off their entire body chemistry. I wonder, like the zinc, if maybe they're missing something that they need in order to make hydrochloric acid.
Well,
I haven't seen science on it, but I think it makes sense.
Well, it does seem to make sense. I agree with that. And quite honestly, I hadn't thought of it till one of our listeners posed the question.
You've got a sharp group out there. I'm impressed.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because they keep me on my toes. I can't really pull anything over their eyes and ears. But I try, but they usually catch me out, and then I'm in trouble. So I've got to do my homework. But, yeah, they're pretty sharp. And actually, some of the questions I asked were from some of the listeners, even if it seemed like they were my own. But they're a little too sharp. You've got to get up pretty early in the morning for this crowd. Let me ask you, though, about H. pylori and candida and the candida overgrowth and all of that. Could that cause low stomach acid or cause a problem with, seemingly to have too much an overly acidic nature?
Yes. The yeast such as candida, when you make the environment for your good bacteria, your probiotics, inhospitable, then the yeast can take over. They are very inflammatory, and there is something called candida esophagitis where the esophagus can become very inflamed just because there's so much yeast there. But I think even a little bit later on interferes with digestion and absorption and can create a circular problem. That H. pylori, Helicobacter pylori, is probably the most common infection worldwide. An Australian, actually, tough guy, swallowed some to show that those were really the cause of ulcers, 70%. The other 30% are related to these non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. But it also causes gastritis, this bug, and can cause acid reflux and even lead to various kinds of cancers. But it's one of those things that when you really study the science on it, I had the hardest time with that of anything in doing that book, was because it also seems to have a little bit of a protective role, and that if you use really very, very strong protocols for getting rid of it with antibiotics, at least, that you're almost worse off than if you left it alone. That's why I like just controlling it with natural things, because then you seem to get the best of both.
So, I mean, controlling it with natural things, one of the things that comes to mind actually is red wine. I've read and heard that red wine will kill H. pylori, and as will, I believe, garlic and mastic gum. Mastic gum is a very good, although somewhat expensive, way of doing it. What do you think of those natural?
Yeah, actually, I think one of the reasons that moderate alcohol consumption always turns out to be a health benefit rather than a health risk is because it kind of sterilizes the stomach. And if you don't have the stomach acid there to be your barrier against H. pylori, a little alcohol maybe is going to help. Of course, there's resveratrol and other things in the red wine. But on a turmeric, that's one of those things, curcumin from the spiced turmeric, sulforaphane from broccoli sprouts. Those are some things that are also very helpful against H. pylori.
One of the readers wanted me to, or listeners, sorry, wanted me to ask you a particular question. He writes that when he eats a banana, he gets very bad heartburn within 15 to 20 minutes. Do you know why that could be?
This is the biochemical individuality, you know very well, Dr. Williams, some people find bananas relieve their heartburn. So if it causes heartburn for this listener, I would say either it's because it's too concentrated a carbohydrate or they have a sensitivity to it. And maybe to try not eating bananas along with the food, eating them instead by themselves and see if that also produces the heartburn. If it does, I'd find something else to eat.
Well, one other person, I think it was Bill Sardi, also talked about cinnamon as being good for H. pylori too. But I don't know if you have any experience with that. But anyway, that's one possibility.
If Bill Sardi said it, it must be true.
He's been on our program, you know, and we were very fortunate to have him on too. And this is the beauty of having you, Marty, on. And again, for those listeners who have just joined us, we have Marty Whittakin on, who is a nutritional consultant, health freedom activist for many years on both counts, does in her own right a nationally syndicated, at least nationally in the U.S., radio program, and very, very popular. So, you know, even though we compliment Bill Sardi, I have to say I'm very fortunate. We're very fortunate to have you on.
Thank you.
Is Marty, or let me ask you another question, just looping back to this thing. Are drugs the only thing mainstream medicine has to offer for this sort of problem of excess, low stomach acid?
As far as I know, talking to hundreds of people, that's all they've been told. And I think doctors want to do the right thing, but when they look in their tool bag, that's what's in there. You know, as I do, the doctor understand alternative medicine, nutritional medicine, even integrative medicine. They have had to, at their own expense, leave the practice, go somewhere to a conference and miss some time in the office. And they have to really be motivated and have a clue that there's something there of value, because it's so easy to get all of their continuing medical education units going to a fancy dinner sponsored by a drug company. So once they cross over and they learn all this, then it's like there's no going back. They'll only use certain drugs in special cases, but they find natural ways to solve almost every problem.
Yeah. And have you found any particular group of doctors? If someone wanted to go and get one of those, retain one of those good doctors, is there an organization where you could find those that you would particularly recommend to the crowd here?
ACAM.org, I believe it is. That's one group of docs that are by and large pretty good. The naturopathic physicians that went to a medical school like Bastyr or, and I'm particularly fond of that one. I was on the board of trustees for a couple of years there, and I just saw firsthand how dedicated and smart they are. But there are now a number of those kinds of naturopathic medical schools. They're going to be good. Sometimes you have to piece one together. You find a tolerant doctor who will let you do what you want to do, and you go to a good nutritionist and maybe a chiropractor, and you kind of put together your own program, because not every community is blessed with somebody who's able to depart from the cookbook that the medical associations and the regulators use in their state to decide what's good practice and what isn't.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you about ACAM. For those of you who don't know what ACAM stands for, it's American College for the Advancement of Medicine. They're based in Southern California, and a really good group of doctors who are interested in not just the mainstream drug-oriented approach, but really what will help heal people. And one of the ACAM founders, Ross Gordon, was on our National Health Federation Board of Governors for many years, and he said something that I thought was incredibly sensible. I remember him telling me that what he would give as advice to all the new doctors who join, well, with whom he came in contact, was the number one duty of doctors is, I don't know about number one, but amongst the top duties of doctors is to find those cures that have never been, that are out there but have not been found yet, to find those cures. And so I thought that was very good advice. And anyway, I appreciate that organization. And you know, it's funny that you, not funny in a strange way, just good that you mentioned that them as well. So in any event.
Scott, can I give a bit of advice for finding? You can go on their website and find maybe somebody in your area, but failing that, go to a compounding pharmacy or a good old-timey natural food store where the people really still talk to the customers, and ask the owner, not somebody that just, you know, worked at Home Depot last week and is running the cash register, and ask him, who do you get good feedback on? And maybe that will give you a line on somebody that's in your area, because some of these people are under the radar. They don't want to attract the attention of their peers because they tend to get smacked.
Yeah, that's really good advice. And, you know, it sort of parallels when people ask me, or if I need it myself, they ask, oh, how do you find a good attorney, you know, if such a thing exists? I say, go to your local courthouse, you know, assuming you want an attorney who's a trial attorney, a barrister as opposed to a solicitor. You go to your local courthouse and you ask the court clerk who sees these attorneys come in day and night, you know, the clerk for the judge, and you say, who's a good one? Who's the one you would recommend? And I've done that several times to find someone in a neighborhood or an area or a county that I'm not familiar with, to find and locate a good attorney. And so you're giving similar advice with respect to locating a good doctor. But you are right, and I know that from my conversations with the ACAM executive director, Michael Buteau. He had mentioned how on their website, you can just plug in your address, and I know they're in something like 29 different countries. ACAM is, so you can find things there. We also, on our website, although you have to send in for it, but we are going to change this very soon, the National Health Federation at thenhf.com, we have available a list of doctors that are doctors who are basically alternative type doctors and available. So
I would like to put that link on my website. If you don't mind, I'd like to give it out, because I have that free newsletter, and I try to take my job as translating, find some new things that are in the research and put it in there, and also podcasts, or you can listen online to my show if it doesn't have to be broadcast in your area, but it's radiomarty.com.
Okay. Yes. For those of you who just joined us again, it's www.radiomartie. And that's a great website to go. Sign up for a free newsletter that will give you all sorts of health tips and alert you to what's going on in the world. Because while we've focused on Marty's expertise in nutrition and health, really, I mean, and we did talk about this, we touched upon it at the beginning of the program, but her expertise is not only in nutrition, writing books, and we haven't even touched the subject of aloe vera, upon which you're a huge expert, Marty, but is really your health freedom activist nature. And I'm sure you have tons of war stories on that. I would love to talk about here, because you would educate me upside, downside, and crosswise many times over, I'm sure, on that subject as much as I've done. I still am very impressed with what you've done with in that direction, because we need it. That's part of what we really have is as a problem is we have a lot of people who are interested, but there aren't that many people willing to step up to the plate and engage in health freedom activist work. So you're a real rarity, and one I have to honor for what you've done and what the freedoms you've helped us preserve. So I really thank you for that. And
thank you for that kind word. You know, Scott, I wouldn't wish what I ended up having to do probably on anybody. I was 1 year, I made 26 trips to Washington, and I kept getting blindsided on radio interviews. They'd say it was a friendly interview, and then I'd find out I was debating somebody from CSPI, the Center for Science and the Public Interest, or somebody from the FDA. And yeah, I have some really interesting war stories, but I came away with a profound respect for how important it is for consumers who are voters to speak their mind and stand up and be counted, pick up the phone, write a letter, petitions, not so much. But by doing that, the only thing we sometimes want to pretend like maybe Congress can be bought off. Well, there's money in the system, but the only thing that they're more interested in getting more money for their campaigns is what do the voters think? Because it's all about getting reelected, whether it's money or votes. So when somebody calls, they may think, hey, I'm just one person. It makes a difference.
You know, it's funny. Someone once said when politicians are running for election, you are a constituent. When they get elected, you're a taxpayer. And that's the way they treat us. You know, they have our interest at heart so long as they want to get elected. And then afterwards, they treat us like dirt. And we see that.
But they're running for office all the time.
True. True.
It's they now become a permanent occupation. They're either fundraising or running. So
yeah, it's true. Certainly for those who can run again, where there aren't term limits, but most of them are just permanent politicians in office, and they seem to get elected at least at the higher rungs of power. They seem to get elected reelected no matter what. But certainly the congressmen and the congresswomen, I would totally agree with you on. They are always running. And then either for the same office or other offices, and I think that's something that needs to. We call it being persistently vocal. When you contact them, they will listen to a constituent more than any other person, and get your friends and family and just basically pester them.
And do it before there's a big issue, because then you want to have a contact with them when there isn't a crisis, because then you kind of know the ropes. They kind of know you. It's great when they're back in the district to go in, call them and say, hey, true, I just want to meet you. Thank you for what you're doing, and be respectful and say, and I just want you to know these are things that are important to me, and list your issues in general so they have that for background. And if health freedom is important to you, tell them what that looks like and just say, I appreciate your support. And then if you have to go back when there's actually legislation pending, then you're just reminding them.
Yes, absolutely. And so you're establishing a relationship beforehand, which is a great approach. And I like that. And we've done that at NHF with a number of different politicians. We had that with Dan Burton, and that's one reason he introduced our H.R. 3380, the Dietary Supplement Protection Act, and we're having to reintroduce it. It didn't pass this year. You know, it was the bill to protect the new dietary ingredients from the grubby, power-hungry hands of the FDA, and it didn't pass primarily because the focus on the presidential elections and also on the so-called fiscal cliff, but we're reintroducing it. Marty, I'd really love to get you involved in that if you would be interested. And I don't mean to put you on the spot on the air, but at some point, we're nearing the end of the program. I would love to talk to you about doing just that if you're open to it.
Well, sure. That new dietary ingredient protocols are, it's just, there's some bizarre stuff in there. We've got to protect the consumers from that, and whatever I can do to help, I'd be glad to. And I know we'll talk about it when you're on my show, as well as Codex, which somebody came up to me with Saturday after this talk, with what I hope is some misguided information about Codex, but there seems to be a lot of confusion.
Oh, there definitely is, and we've been picking that up. People who have been to just one meeting hold themselves out as some sort of expert on Codex Alimentarius, or some who had not been for years. And it's always changing, you know, and it's not monolithic. It's not a monolithic entity. And there's most definitely a lot of misinformation out there. In fact, I would call it disinformation in many cases. People are deliberately misleading people over Codex. Codex is a threat, but it's not always a threat in the way they are being told it is. And it's really a shame. It's like some of these people have a plan, perhaps, I don't know, to deliberately mislead people, lead them down the garden path, but they say all the magic words. You know, they say FDA is bad, Codex is evil, you know, Codex will remove, you know, all the people from the planet except for the magic 500,000 that will be left because of the Georgia Guidestones and what the elite are saying. And, you know, it's just a shame because there are things that can be done at Codex and things that can't. Well, we just have enough of that, but we have a few minutes left, and I just want to summarize for those who didn't hear the beginning that we have with us Marty Whitaker, and we were talking about seemingly excess stomach acid, which is really usually a sign of low stomach acid, and that the answer is not drugs like Nexium. It's not Maalox or the other drugs that are out there, and that unfortunately a lot of doctors feel that this is the only solution, the only thing they really know about, and there's a lot of pressure on them to just prescribe drugs and then push the patient out the door and be done with it, when in fact there actually exist natural solutions that Marty spoke about and educated us on. And again, I refer you to her website, www.radiomartie.com. Please go there. Marty, are there any last words of wisdom that you would like to leave us with before we have to go? It's almost the top of the hour.
Yes, something you can do to improve your digestion that doesn't cost anything. Calm down, focus on the food, and chew your food thoroughly.
I love that, and that is so perfect. Thank you, Marty, so much for being with us. And, you know, just everyone. Thank you. Marty, to the audience here, is such a font of information, and we just barely touched the surface. So I'd love to have you on again if and when you have time. And for those of you listening, stay tuned for Sean McGuire, always an interesting host, always interesting material. Next week, the 30th of January, to be honest with you, I think I will be on. I don't know that I'll be on because my mother is having a very important operation the day before. So depending upon how it goes, I'll either be on or not. So please just stay tuned. And we may not know till the last minute, but quite honestly, I'm planning on being on. So I should be there, but if things go south, I may not. So Hope you're all well. Stay tuned for Sean McGuire, as I said, and thank you all for listening. As Marty herself said, you guys and gals are one very smart crowd, and I really appreciate each and every one of you, and I appreciate your questions, and I'll see you, hopefully, talk to you next week. Okay. Thanks, Marty, and thanks, everyone else.
Thank you.